Last week we saw the stories of the Israelites coming into their promised land, the land that God had promised from way back at the time of Abraham when he had called him and promised to give this land to his descendants. We saw the stories involved with God giving them this land and what was involved there. Today we're going to continue on. The next book in our Bible is the book of Judges, and it's just a continuation of the story. It's thought that maybe the book of Joshua and the book of Judges were both written by Samuel. They at least seem to be written in Samuel's time, but they may have been compiled or put together by Samuel. So you'll see references in there to such and such is still here to this day, and so that is thinking that that's at Samuel's time. As we've seen, the Israelites came into the Promised Land, and we looked at the stories there. But they had a job to do. There was a gift that God was giving them of this land, but they played a part in it. And God gave them a command before they came into the Promised Land, before they came in to the heartland of the Promised Land, that is on the west side of the Jordan River. What was it that God commanded of them? In fact, this was commanded way back in the book of Numbers before they even came to the Promised Land. And these are words from Moses, Numbers 33, starting at verse 50. On the plains of Moab by the Jordan, across from Jericho, Yahweh said to Moses, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into Canaan, drive out all the inhabitants of the land before you. Destroy all of their carved images and their cast idols, and demolish all of their high places. Take possession of the land and settle in it, for I have given you this land to possess." So before they went in, God gave them the command to go in and clean it out. Drive out all the inhabitants, get rid of all their idols, get rid of all their temples and shrines to their gods, to their idols, and purify the land as God's land, because this was the land that God was giving to them. Okay? Now, it said to the key part of that was to drive out all the inhabitants. How were they to do that? Deuteronomy chapter 2, starting at verse 24. "Set out now and cross the Arnon Gorge. See, I've given into your hand Sihon the Amorite, king of Heshbon, and his country. Begin to take possession of it and engage him in battle. This very day I will begin to put the terror and fear of you on all the nations under heaven. They'll hear reports of you and will tremble and be in anguish because of you." And then verse 32 and 34. "When Sihon and all his army came out to meet us in battle at Jahaz, Yahweh our God delivered him over to us, and we struck him down, together with his sons and his whole army. At that time we took all the towns and completely destroyed them, men, women, and children. We left no survivors." So how did they drive out all the inhabitants? Well, they destroyed them. It was battle. It was war. And that's what we saw last week. It was they came in and fought them and killed them. Not just killed the armies, not just destroyed their armies, but they killed all the civilians, all the people, the men in the towns that weren't fighting, the women, the children. I don't know about you, but that sounds kind of, I don't know, God, isn't there a better way? It says that God delivered them over. God gave them these victories, and we saw that in our stories last week, that God was involved to provide them with victories that there's no way that they could have achieved on their own. And we'll see that again some more today. But God's a loving God. How could a loving God condone and even command and even be involved with such violence? Well, turn to Romans chapter 1. Starting at verse 18, it says, "The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness." Verse 21, "For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Furthermore, since they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, he gave them over to a depraved mind to do what ought not to be done. They've become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. They're full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, and malice. They're gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, and boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. They're senseless, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Although they know God's righteous decree that those who do such things deserve death, they not only continue to do these very things, but they also approve of those who practice them. And this is a description of mankind after mankind has turned away from God. And that's what we have there with the people of Canaan, that they were given freedom to worship Him, to be His people, or to reject Him. And these people had chosen to reject Him. As we reject God, we suffer the consequences. You see here in Romans, you know, God is a just God. God is a loving God and a merciful God, but God is also a just God and therefore must punish sin. And the sins of the Canaanites and Amorites and all the Etzerites have were heaped upon heaped. And we'll see some of that. We'll see some of that in the coming weeks. We really haven't talked about those sins, but you'll see those played out as we get further and further into our stories in the Old Testament. If you look way back in Genesis 15, when God promised this land to Abraham, God made a comment, just in passing, that kind of sheds a little light on why the inhabitants of Canaan were later treated so harshly. Genesis chapter 15, verse 16 says, "In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sins of the Amorites have not yet reached its full measure." So the sins of the Amorites have not yet reached its full measure, but later on, when your descendants come back here, they will have. Okay? So at this time, the sins of the Amorites have reached their full measure. So, what kind of sins could draw out such wrath from God? Deuteronomy 18, starting at verse 9. "When you enter the land that Yahweh your God has given you, do not learn to imitate the detestable ways of the nations there." So we see it's detestable the way they act. In what ways? "Well, let no one be found among you who sacrifices his son or his daughter in the fire." And we'll see this as we go on. "Who practices divination or sorcery, interprets omens, engages in witchcraft or casts spells, or who's a medium or spiritist or who consults the dead. Anyone who does these things is detestable to Yahweh, and because of these detestable practices, Yahweh your God will drive out those nations before you. But you must be blameless before Yahweh your God." Okay? So, pagan worship, the kind of sins that the Etzerites were guilty of was this pagan worship that involved all sorts of things. And this just barely touches on it. But some of the greater things are child sacrifices to the gods, divination, idolatry, witchcraft. Elsewhere we'll see religious prostitution. That was a big part of these fertility religions, that you would have sex with shrine prostitutes to help encourage the gods to do the same and therefore be fertile and make the land fertile, those kind of things. And those are the practices of these people that were living in the land there. Okay, so was this really punishment for their sins? Their sins of child sacrifices and idolatry and rejection of God? Or was that just God's excuse to give this land to His chosen people? Well, look back at Leviticus chapter 18, starting at verse 24. It says, "Do not defile yourself in any of these ways, because this is how the nations that I'm going to drive out before you became defiled. Even the land was defiled, so I punished it for its sin, and the land vomited out its inhabitants. But you must keep my decrees and my laws. The native-born and the aliens living among you must not do any of these detestable things. For all these things were done by the people who lived in the land before you, and the land became defiled. And if you defile the land, it will vomit you out as it vomited out the nations that were before you." So what does that sound like? It sounds like what went for the Etzerites also goes for the Israelites. If you practice these practices, if you behave, if you reject God, if you reject me, God says, like these Canaanites and Hittites and Hivites and Amorites have all done, then I will treat you the same way that I'm treating them. I will spit you out just like I spit them out. So, this is punishment. this is truly God's punishment as a just God for the horrible, detestable practices of the Etzerites. Okay? It looks harsh to us, but what's even more harsh, what's even more violent and painful, is the rejection of the Etzerites of God. So the Israelites were to drive out all the inhabitants by destroying them, okay, getting rid of them. Why was it important for them to drive out the inhabitants of the land? Why couldn't they just stay away from them and leave them there, leave them be? Numbers 33, going on, starting at verse 55. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land, those you allow to remain will become barbs in your eyes. Ooh, that sounds pretty painful. And thorns in your sides. They will give you trouble in the land where you live. And then I will do to you what I plan to do to them. So there we see that warning again, that if they take on the practices of these Etzerites, then God will treat them the same way. But they are to drive those inhabitants of the land out. Otherwise, they are going to be barbs in your eyes, thorns in your side. They're going to be a temptation for you to sin, a temptation for you to draw away from me, for you to practice the detestable practices of them. As we participate, as you know, those of you who are parents, one of your big concerns is what kind of friends do your kids have? Because whoever your kids hang around, they'll become like them. And what is acceptable for those kids, for your kids' friends, your kids will start seeing as acceptable. The same goes here. God didn't want them to associate with, to have anything to do with other peoples, pagan peoples, people who had rejected him. They were to be his holy people, cut off, separate, circumcised from the world, so that they could be with God and not be tempted by these other detestable practices. So therefore, they were to drive out the inhabitants, not just some of them, but all of them. Wipe it clean. Okay? And we saw that last week. We saw as, Moses died, he wiped out and cleaned the eastern part of to the east side of the Jordan River with the conquest over Sihon and then Og. And all that eastern side was wiped clean, except you had the Ammonites, the Moabites, and the Edomites that were left. But those were left because God said that the Israelites could not have their land, that that land was his gift to those people being brothers from way up at Abraham's time. But when they came across, we saw Joshua took over for Moses, and Joshua led all the battles, and we saw this conquest of the promised land. While Joshua was there and Joshua was leading these armies, were the Israelites able to conquer the entire territory and drive all the inhabitants away? Turn to Joshua chapter 13, verse 1. When Joshua was old and well advanced in years, Yahweh said to him, "You're very old, and there's still very large areas of land to be taken over." And then it goes on and identifies a bunch of land, the lands of the Philistines and the Geshurites, from all these rivers up at the all of Lebanon to the east and Mount Hermon, etc. So there's a lot of area that was there, as well as some miscellaneous spots scattered around within the territory. So there were still large areas to be taken. Okay, was it God's call to Joshua to wipe it clean? Joshua was to lead them, and Joshua led them, and they followed him, and they wiped clean under Joshua's leadership. But after Joshua was gone, they were to continue this and to finish the job. And so you see that with Joshua. As he neared his deathbed and was old, he had a number of parting comments to the people, and he told the Israelites in some of his comments what to do about those people left over. Chapter 23, starting at verse 7. "Do not associate with these nations that remain among you. Do not invoke the names of their gods or swear by them. You must not serve them or bow down to them. But you are to hold fast to Yahweh your God, as you have until now. Yahweh has driven out before you great and powerful nations. To this day, no one has been able to withstand you. One of you routs a thousand. because Yahweh your God fights for you, just as he promised. So, be careful to love Yahweh your God. But if you turn away and ally yourself with the survivors of these nations that remain among you, and if you intermarry with them and associate with them, oh, then you may be sure that Yahweh your God will no longer drive out these nations before you. Instead, they will become snares and traps for you, whips on your backs and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from this good land which Yahweh your God has given you. So he warns them and says, stay faithful to God. Do not be tempted by these peoples who are here. Stay faithful to God, and God will continue to work with you and through you to drive these peoples out and to give you this land to its fullest. Okay? But if you instead make allies, make friends with these people, if you don't stay separate, if you intermarry with them and live together with them, well, then they're going to be a temptation. They're going to be a trap. They're going to be a snare. They're going to be this whip, barbs in your eye problem for you. Okay? So Joshua gives them this warning before before he goes on. Okay? So that's their task. That's their responsibility. Do they do it? Do they continue to work to drive out all the inhabitants of the land? Let's go on. The next book, Judges, chapter 1. After the death of Joshua, the Israelites asked Yahweh, who will be the first to go up and fight for us against the Canaanites? Yahweh answered, Judah is to go. I've given the land into their hands. Well, then the men of Judah said to Simeonites, their brothers, come up and with us into the territory allotted to us to fight against the Canaanites. We, in turn, will go with you into yours. So the Simeonites went with them. When Judah attacked, Yahweh gave the Canaanites and Perizzites into their hands, and they struck down 10,000 men at Bezek. And then verse 17, we see, then the men of Judah went with the Simeonites, their brothers, and attacked the Canaanites living in Zephath, and they totally destroyed, that is, Hered. They committed the city to God. Therefore, it was called Hormah, which means destruction. So we see that, did they continue to work to drive out the inhabitants? Yes. After Joshua died, they looked, okay, who goes next? And where should we go next? And God said, Judah go. Now it's interesting to see that Judah looked for help. They already had all the help they needed from God. But they went to their brothers, the Simeonites. Now there's a relationship there. Judah and Simeon were full blood brothers. But if you look at a map of the locations of the tribes, you'll see that Simeon was in the middle of Judah. Okay? Judah had this nice land to the north, then there was Simeon, but then Judah also had the Negev and the desertish land to the south of Simeon, and then also some to the east and west of Simeon. So Simeon was kind of in the middle. So it makes sense that they go together, but it is interesting to see that that they didn't just recognize that God was going to be behind them and they took off. Instead they asked for help. But you do see that the two work together here. But if you look, it's just those tribes. Not all of Israel worked together. Okay, now people had gone home to their homes, and so now we'll start seeing that it's a tribe by tribe kind of thing, or a group by group kind of thing. So you see that there was some of this. Now, did they continue to heed Joshua's warning and continue to drive out the remaining people? Well, we'll just read a few of the verses. Verse 19, Yahweh was with the men of Judah. They took possession of the hill country, but they were unable to drive the people from the plains because they had iron chariots. In 27, but Manasseh did not drive out the people of Bethshan or Tanakh or Dor or Ibleam or Megiddo and their surrounding settlements, for the Canaanites were determined to live in the land. When Israel became strong, they pressed the Canaanites into forced labor, but never drove them out completely. And you can go on through the rest of the chapter, and it just says over and over again how all these tribes didn't do their job. Okay? They only went so far. But when things started getting tough, when they started running into iron chariots, or they started running into Canaanites who fought back, they gave up. They didn't trust God to continue to give them victory. They didn't continue to work for that victory, trusting God. And so they left people there. they put Canaanites into servitude, kind of like we saw last week with the Gibeonites. But that's not what God called them to do. He said, get rid of them or they will be traps. They will be problems for you. Okay? But they didn't get rid of all of them. They left them. They left a bunch. So, how did this set the stage for the stories that we see in the book of Judges? Chapter 2. The angel of Yahweh went up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I brought you out of Egypt and I led you into the land that I swore to give you your forefathers. I said, I will never break my covenant with you. And you shall not make a covenant with the people of this land, but you'll break down their altars. Yet, you've disobeyed me. Why have you done this? Now therefore I tell you, I will not drive them out before you. They will be thorns in your sides, and their gods will be snare to you. When the angel of Yahweh had spoken these things to all the Israelites, the people wept aloud, and they called that place Bochim, which means weeping. There they offered sacrifices to Yahweh. So God came to them, sent an angel that said, I gave you this command, and you're not following through with it. You've ignored it. So since you will not trust me to drive out these people and work with me to drive out these people from before you, then I'm not going to be there to help you with it anymore. I'm going to leave them there. They will become snares and traps and trouble for you. And so that's what we see. That sets the stage for the stories that we have in the book of Judges. Okay? So, we have the Israelites in the Promised Land with some of the Etzerites still around. Now, what were their intentions like? Were their intentions to be faithful? Were their intentions to continue and do the work that that was before them? What was Joshua's last words that he spoke to the Israelites before sending them home? Back in Joshua chapter 24, it says, Now fear Yahweh and serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods your forefathers worshipped beyond the river and in Egypt and serve Yahweh. But if serving Yahweh seems undesirable to you, well, then choose for yourself today who you will serve, whether the gods that your forefathers served beyond the rivers or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you're now living. But as for me and my household, we will serve Yahweh. Okay? So you decide, who are you going to serve? Choose today. Who's your God? Is it Yahweh, who brought you out of here and has given you all these victories over the Egyptians, over the various Etzerites, given you this land? Or do you want to worship the gods of the Israelites, of the Egyptians? Or do you want to worship the gods of the Egyptians? Or the gods of the Amorites? Or the gods even of the Abraham's forefathers across the river? Okay, you decide. For me and my household, we're going to serve Yahweh. And what was their answer? Verse 24. And the people said to Joshua, We will serve Yahweh our God and obey him. So you see, they had this intention and this plan. So, were they? How faithful did the Israelites remain? Judges chapter 2, starting at verse 6. After Joshua had dismissed the Israelites, they went to take possession of the land, each to his own inheritance. The people served Yahweh throughout the lifetime of Joshua and of the elders who outlived him, and all who had seen all the great things that Yahweh had done for Israel. And we'll jump to verse 10. After that, the whole generation had been gathered up to their fathers. Another generation grew up who knew neither Yahweh nor what he had done for Israel. Then the Israelites did eyes in the eyes of Yahweh and served the Baals. They forsook the Yahweh, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshipped various gods of the peoples around them. They provoked Yahweh to anger because they forsook him and served Baal and the Asherahs. So, did they remain faithful? They remained faithful as long as Joshua was there, or even the elders that, and the people who had seen all God's mighty hands at the victories in the Promised Land. But once those people died off, even though the stories were conveyed to them, the new generations forgot about God and turned away from God, and turned, because they had left these people in the land, they turned to the gods of the Amorites, of the Canaanites, of the Perizzites, of the Girgashites, of the Hittites, of all the other ites that are there. And they started serving their gods. You see it says that they served Baal. Baal is a name for all sorts of different gods that that they had, various male gods for various places or purposes. You go to a certain place, and it has its own Baal. Okay, each town, each city, each location, whatever, would have their own Baal, or there were Baals for different purposes as well. Baal was considered to be the son of El, El being the chief god of the Canaanites. Whenever you see the word El, it just means God. It means the word God. It says also here that they also served in verse 13, said that they also served the Ashtoreths. What was the Ashtoreth? And as you go through, you'll also see comments about Asherah poles. Well, Ashtoreth and Asherah were female gods. They were the female consorts, not quite wives, but maybe concubines or whatever, consorts of Baal and El, respectively. Okay, Ashtoreth with Baal and Asherah with El. These have this, they have other names too. In the Babylonians called them Ishtar. The Greeks called them Astarte and Aphrodite. Romans called Venus. Okay, same gods or goddesses there that are worshipped. Why? Why did they fall away from God so quickly? Why did they continue to fall away from God over and over again? Judges chapter 3 reminds us. The Israelites lived among the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. They took their daughters in marriage and gave their own daughters to their sons and served their gods. Why did they continue to fall away from God? For the very reason that God wanted them to drive out all the inhabitants and wipe the place clean. Because they left those people and they became snares to them. They became temptations to them. They didn't remain the separate, cut-off people that God commanded them from way back at Abraham's time. That He even gave them the sign of circumcision to remind them on a daily basis. But yet, they continued to fall away because they united themselves with these pagan peoples and therefore picked up their pagan ways and picked up their pagan worship and worship of their idols and gods. So what did God do in response? How did God handle that? Chapter 2, verse 14. In His anger against Israel, Yahweh handed them over to raiders who plundered them. He sold them to their enemies all around, whom they were no longer able to resist. Whenever Israel went out to fight, the hand of Yahweh was against them to defeat them, just as He had sworn to them. They were in great distress. So, how did He handle their rejection of Him and their rejection of His command to stay separate, to not mix with these people, and their rejection of Him through worshiping the other gods? God punished them, just as He said He would. Okay? He brought raiders. He brought enemies. He brought trouble upon them. He brought raiders in who created problems inside Israel for them and let these enemies defeat them. He gave them losses. He would not side with them. In fact, He would side against them and punish them for their apostasy, for their sin. But then they'd cry out to God. Okay, verse 16. Okay, they were in great distress at the end of verse 15, and they would cry out to God, they'd recognize their sin, and then we see in verse 16, then Yahweh raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of these raiders. Whenever Yahweh raised up a judge for them, He was with that judge and saved them out of the hands of their enemies as long as the judge lived. For Yahweh had compassion on them as they groaned under those who oppressed them and afflicted them. So they would cry out to God, and God in turn raised up judges. Now the word for judges here is shofet. And it doesn't mean this guy in a black robe sitting behind a bench that we normally think of. Now, it can mean a judge like that, but it also means a leader. It means a director. It means a governor or a judge or a savior. Someone in command. So God would raise up a leader is really kind of what that's saying there. Did these judges have a lasting effect on Israel's faithfulness? Going on. But when the judge died, the people returned to ways even more corrupt than those of their fathers, following other gods and serving and worshiping them. They refused to give up their evil practices and stubborn ways. So, just like with Joshua, when Joshua died and that generation died off, the next generation turned away from God, you'd see a return to faithfulness during the life of a judge. But then once the judge died, the people turned away and even turned more away, it says, in ways even more corrupt than those of their fathers. Okay, so what did God decide as a result of this response? Verse 20, therefore Yahweh was very angry with Israel and said, because this nation has violated the covenant that I laid down for their forefathers and has not listened to me, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations that Joshua left when he died. I will use them to test Israel and see whether they will keep the way of Yahweh and walk in it as their forefathers did. So he decided that he, just as he had promised before or forewarned before, that he was not going to drive these people out and leave them there as tests for them, tests of their faithfulness to him. Okay? He would allow the other nations to remain to test Israel. So what you have there in those verses that we just read in chapter 2 is a little quick little summary of what you find in the rest of the book. And it's a cycle that's repeated over and over. In fact, it's the same cycle that we saw back in the early books of Genesis, Genesis 4 through 11, and we looked and we saw that there was a sin. Mankind would sin. Okay, God is a just God and must punish sin, and so he would issue his judgment and punishment for that sin. But God is also a merciful and loving God, and then God sends his grace. So you have a sin, judgment, grace cycle that we saw in Genesis 4 through 11 when we looked at that a few months ago. That's what we see here. It's also what we saw when we looked at the stories of Israel in the wilderness. It's also what we see when we look at our own lives. And we look at the sin that we commit. We look at the way that God judges that. And then we also look at his grace that he pours out of his love. So you have the sin, judgment, grace cycle. You also, another way to look at it, there's, you can call it the alphabet cycle. Okay, there's apostasy, which means unbelief and rebellion. Okay, so the people would rebel, would fall away from God, fall away from faith, and then God would raise up the raiders and they would be battered. They would be beat upon by enemies. After some time, they would then recognize their problem and they would call out to God. They would cry out and confess their sin and turn from their sin, repent from their sin. God, in response then, would raise up a deliverer. He would call up a judge to come and a leader to save them, and that judge would emancipate them, would free Israel from the oppression. But then, after that judge died, Israel would forget and forget what God did, and then return to the front of the cycle with apostasy. And you've got that cycle over and over and over again throughout the book of Judges. Okay? Why? Well, just a little background here about how the organization here, because what we're looking at on these judges, they really weren't judges for all of Israel. Okay? You see that Moses led all of Israel. Well, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob did too, but there weren't as many of them back then. But with this large group of people, Moses led them. When Moses died, Joshua led them, and he was recognized as their leader. But now that Joshua's dead, they go on, and I don't know, what kind of leader do they have then? What kind of leadership does Israel have? Look back at the back of Judges, chapter 21, verse 25. And this kind of gives you the bottom line reason for a lot of the problems here. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. Okay, everyone did as he saw fit. So there was no central leader. Why not? What was the view that the Israelites had of a king? This is a response from Gideon in our story for today, chapter 8, verse 22 to 23. The Israelites said to Gideon, "Rule over us, you, your son, and your grandson, because you've saved us out of the hand of Midian." But Gideon told them, "I will not rule over you, nor will my son rule over you. Yahweh will rule over you. So why did they have no king? Because they did have a king. The king was God. God was their king. What better king can you ask for than God? With God on your side, nothing is impossible. With God on your side, you've got the best king you could ever have. No man could ever be a king anything like God. Okay? So there was no central leadership other than God. Now, what you had is these tribes. You had the various tribes, and there was a confederacy here. And how tight of a confederacy was there between these tribes? Well, first Judges 6, verse 35. This is just an example. Gideon sent messengers throughout Manasseh, calling them to arms, and then also into Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, so that they too went up to meet them. And you've got a number of other verses here on your sheet, 1:3, 1:17, and 20 verse 1 as other examples that you see that the tribes would occasionally band together and come together to help each other out. But we also see some other interesting things. Judges chapter 20, verse 35, and we'll talk more about this next week. Verse 35, Yahweh defeated Benjamin before Israel, and on that day the Israelites struck down 25,100 Benjamites, all armed with swords. Who are the Benjamites? That was one of the tribes, the tribe of Benjamin. And you also see in chapter 5, and chapter 8, chapter 12, you see there was also fighting between the tribes. So sometimes the tribes would come together to help each other out. Sometimes they would fight against each other. And we'll see that as we go on. So you had kind of a weird confederacy here. Sometimes positive, sometimes negative. When the enemies would pop up, they would sometimes band together. Now, who were these enemies? Well, I've picked you a few verses that show you some of them. If you look at those, you'll see Mesopotamia. You know, that's up there between the two rivers, the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers, where Aram is the name of the land up there where Abraham had come from. Moab, the Moabites, we've talked about them. The Canaanites, Midianites, okay, Ammonites, the descendants of Lot. The other descendants of Lot, you got Moab and you got Ammon. And then the Philistines. And we'll see a lot of it with the Philistines as we keep going on. And each one of these were these different enemies that God would allow to come in and create problems for the Israelites because of their apostasy. What about the judges? Who were they? Well, they were not kings of all Israel. They were not leaders of all Israel. They were more so local heroes that God raised up to deal with a specific problem at hand. These enemies were typically not creating problems for all of Israel, but for specific areas in Israel. And then the judges were people that God raised to deal with those problems in those areas. The leadership was of being a leader, of being a judge, of being a shofet, was that person was chosen by God. It was not something that was inherited, not something that someone asked to become. Okay. Now, where do they come from? Where does this idea come from? Well, Exodus 18, we first see where judges played a part in Israel, or leaders. And this is when Jethro guides Moses into setting up a delegated organization for leading the nation, of setting leaders over tens and fifties and hundreds and thousands. And so those were called judges or shofets. Hebrews 11, the great chapter on faith, refers to him. Verse 32, "And what more shall I say? I do not have time to tell about Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah." Those are all judges that we'll talk about here in the book of Judges. "David, Samuel, and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions and quenched the fury of the flames and escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength and who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies." Okay? So they were faithful people. Okay? Through faith they conquered kingdoms. Through faith they administered justice. Through faith they led Israel. Through faith they brought salvation to Israel from their enemies at the time. Okay? So let's start looking at some of these judges. We'll just start. We're only going to get part of the way today, and we'll finish up next week with the rest of the book of Judges. We have a number of minor judges and major judges. Okay. Now, what makes the difference between a minor judge and a major judge? Well, we also have in the Bible minor books of prophets and major books of prophets. What's the difference between a minor book of prophet and a major book of prophet? It has to do with the size of the book. Okay? A minor book is a small book, and a major book is a big book, and that's how they're differentiated. Not to say that calling to be a prophet of Habakkuk was any less than the calling to Jeremiah or Isaiah, or that Amos or Obadiah might have been less, or Hosea. It just is the size of the book. Same thing with these judges here. The minor judges are the ones that we don't know a whole lot about, where the major judges we know a lot about. We have chapters on them and lots of stories. The first judge would be what we would call a minor judge. Othniel. How many of you have heard of Othniel? Okay. Well, actually, we have two stories about him. The first story we see in Judges chapter 1, verses 12 to 13. And you remember Caleb. There were two spies way back when who went into the promised land, spied it out, came back and said, yeah, these people are big and powerful and kind of scary, but we got God on our side, so we should trust him. All the other spies said, no, we shouldn't trust him. We should not go in. And one of those was Joshua. The other was Caleb. And so we see in chapter 1, verse 12, Caleb said, and Caleb was given some land by Moses in the promised land. And Caleb said, I will give my daughter Aksa in marriage to the man who attacks and captures Kiriath Sefer. Now Caleb was old at this time. He didn't have the strength to do this, but Kiriath Sefer had some Canaanites, was close by his place, and so he made this offer. And we see in verse 13 that Othniel, son of Kenaz, who was happened to be Caleb's younger brother, took it. So Caleb gave his daughter Aksa to him in marriage. So Caleb's nephew was Othniel. Othniel was Caleb's nephew, and Caleb ended up marrying Caleb's daughter Aksa to become his son-in-law. So we get that information. But we see him again then in chapter 3 as the first judge that pops up in response to some of the problems that the Israelites have. His story really starts in verse 7. I'll just go ahead and start there. The Israelites did evil in the eyes of Yahweh. They forgot Yahweh, their God, served the Baals and the Asherahs. The anger of Yahweh burned against Israel so that he sold them into the hands of Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Aram-Naharim, to whom the Israelites were subject for 8 years. But when they cried out to Yahweh, he raised up for them a deliverer, Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, who saved them. The Spirit of Yahweh came upon him so that he became Israel's judge or leader or shofet and went to war. Yahweh gave Cushan Rishathaim, king of Aram, into the hands of Othniel, who overpowered him. So the land had peace for 40 years until Othniel, son of Kenaz, died. So the first one we see is Othniel. And he defeats the king of Aram, which is the king of Mesopotamia, who came down and created a problem for them. God sold them into the hands of Aram, and they were subject for 8 years, we see. Being subject means that you have to pay tribute. A land that's subject to another land has to pay every year a bunch of money, basically protection money. Because if they didn't pay, then the leading land would come and destroy them and kill them. So we see Othniel, and we see that the land has peace for 40 years after he dies. By the way, as you go through this, and we're not going to get to read all these verses, but watch for how many years the judge was around. You see this 40, which is a great biblical year, meaning a generation. So we have a generation of peace after him. All right, the next story we have, the next oppressor, we see in verse 12, once again the Israelites did evil in the eyes of Yahweh, and because of they did this evil, Yahweh gave Eglon, king of Moab, power over Israel. Getting the Ammonites and Amalekites to join them, Eglon came and attacked Israel, and they took possession of the city of Palms. That's the area there at Jericho. It's an oasis area. So they took possession of that land. The Israelites were subject to Eglon, the king of Moab, for 18 years. Okay? So the Moabites, with help from the Ammonites and the Amalekites, came and took over some of the land of Israel and created problems for the Israelites for 18 years. So who did God raise up as a judge, and what did this guy do? Verse 15. Again, the Israelites cried out to Yahweh, and he gave them a deliverer, Ehud. He was a left-handed man, the son of Gera the Benjamite. The Israelites sent him with tribute to Eglon, the king of Moab. Okay, so again, they were subject, so they had to pay this tribute. And so Eglon was sent with his tribute 1 year. I'll go ahead and read some of this, because this is interesting. Now Ehud had made a double-edged sword about a foot and a half long, which is a cubit, okay, that he strapped to his right thigh under his clothing. Okay, he was left-handed, so he would be able to grab it easily with his left hand. He presented the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab, who was a very fat man. After Ehud had presented the tribute, he sent on their way the men who carried it. At the idols near Gilgal, he himself turned back and said, I have a secret message for you, O king. The king said, quiet, and all his attendants left him. Ehud then approached him while he was sitting alone in the upper room of his summer palace and said, I have a message from God for you. As the king rose from his seat, Ehud reached with his left hand, drew the sword from his right thigh, and plunged it into the king's belly. Even the handle sank in after the blade, which came out his back. Ehud did not pull the sword out, and the fat closed in over it. So you couldn't see the sword that was sticking through him. So you see, Ehud was called to be judge. God raised him up. He went and taking this tribute, and he, on his own, killed Eglon, the king of the Moabites. Now, he gets to get away here, though. Okay, verse 23, he went out to the porch, he shut the doors of the upper room behind him and locked them. After he had gone, the servants came and found the doors of the upper room locked. They said, oh, he must be relieving himself in the inner room of the house. In other words, he must be in the bathroom. They waited to the point of embarrassment, but they couldn't hear him, and they got no answer. So when he did not open the doors of the room, they took a key and unlocked them. And then they saw their Lord fallen to the floor dead. But while they were waiting, Ehud got away. And he passed by the altars and escaped to Sarai. So while they were waiting, thinking that Ehud was in the bathroom, Ehud was able to get away. And then, when he arrived at Syra, he blew a trumpet in the hill country of Ephraim, and the Israelites went down with him from the hills, with him leading them. Follow me, he ordered, for Yahweh has given Moab, your enemy, into your hand. So they followed him down, and taking possession of the fords of the Jordan that led to Moab, they allowed no one to cross over. And at that time they struck down around 10,000 Moabites, all vigorous and strong, not a man escaped. That day Moab was made subject to Israel, and the land had peace for 80 years. Here we have 40 twice. Okay. So he gathered up people from Ephraim, the tribe of Ephraim, and they went and they killed the Moabites trying to cross the Jordan to get back across. And so that was before they found out. You know, Ehud was able to get back and round up the people before word got to the Moabites that were there. Okay? And then we have verse 31, we have another judge that pops up. After Ehud came Shamgar, the son of Anath, who struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad. He too saved Israel. What other information do we have about Shamgar? Nothing. That's it. So he's one of our minor judges. But we do see that he took an ox goad, okay, what you goad an ox with, a prod, and used it to kill 600 Philistines. So God gave him power and might to do that. And we see the Philistines were a problem for the Israelites already at this time. We'll see them much later too. Right? So there in chapter 3, we have Othniel, Ehud, and Shamgar. We've got three judges that we've covered so far. Then we go to chapter 4, and we see another one, Deborah. After Ehud died, the Israelites once again did evil in the eyes of Yahweh, so Yahweh sold them into the hands of Jabin, a king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. Hazor is up north. It's in the northern part, but it is in Israelite land. The commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim. Because he had 900 chariots, iron chariots, and had cruelly oppressed the Israelites for 20 years, so it took them 20 years, and then finally they cry out to Yahweh for help. Now Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was leading Israel at the time. She was holding court under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim, and the Israelites came to her to have their disputes decided. So there you see her acting as a judge, the typical kind of judge, and some of what you see in Exodus 18. And she was acting as a judge, but they were being oppressed. And they were being oppressed in the north. You see, she's down in Ephraim, which is further south. Jabin was the king of Canaan. His army commander was Sisera. So we'll see more about Sisera here. Going on. Deborah sent, verse 6, for Barak, son of Abinoam, from Kadesh in Naphtali, which is up not too far from Hazor, and said to him, Yahweh, the God of Israel, commands you, go and take with you 10,000 men of Naphtali and Zebulun, and lead the way to Mount Tabor. I will lure Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his troops to the Kishon River, and give them into your hands. Okay? So she calls Barak to gather an army and to lead that army into battle against Sisera, but that God would lead Sisera and his troops to a place where the Israelites would have the upper advantage at the Kishon River, and God would deliver them over into his hands. Okay? So again, God's at work here. God's going to bring them this this relief. So how does Barak respond to this call? Barak said to her, if you go with me, I'll go. But if you don't go with me, I won't go. Well, very well, Deborah said, I'll go with you, but because of the way that you're going about this, the honor of the victory will not be yours. For Yahweh will hand Sisera over to a woman. So Deborah went with Barak to Kadesh. So Barak heard Deborah's calling and recognized Deborah's calling, but he trusted not in God but in Deborah. He wanted Deborah to be present. Okay? And so because he wasn't trusting God, Deborah said, okay, you're going to have a victory, but you're not going to get credit for it. The credit will go to a woman. So what happens? Going on, we'll jump to verse 15. At Barak's advance, Yahweh routed Sisera with all his chariots and army by the sword, and Sisera abandoned his chariot and fled on foot. But Barak pursued the chariots and army as far as Harosheth Hagoyim. All the troops of Sisera fell by the sword, not a man was left. Sisera, however, fled on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, because there were friendly relations between Jabin, king of Hazor, and the clan of Heber the Kenite. Now the Kenites were descendants of Jethro, okay, Moses' father-in-law. So that's why they were there in the land. They had come with the Israelites. But there had been some friendly relationships between Jabin, king of Hazor, and this clan. So he ran and went to their encampment, went to the tent of Jael, who's the wife of Heber. And we'll jump down to verse 21. Jael, Heber's wife, picked up a tent peg and a hammer and went quietly to him while he lay fast asleep, exhausted. By the way, I skipped a thing. He had asked for a drink, and she gave him some nice warm milk. So that helped him go to sleep as well. Then she drove the peg, this tent peg, through his temple into the ground, nailed him into the ground through his temple, and he died. Barak came in pursuit of Sisera, and Jael went out to meet him. Come, she said, I'll show you the man that you're looking for. So he went in with her, and there lay Sisera with a tent peg through his temple, dead. Okay. So just as Deborah had said, the victory will go to a woman instead of to Barak because of the way that he was dealing with this. But nonetheless, Israel defeated the Canaanite army. God gave Israel relief from this enemy by raising up Deborah as judge, as leader, and she in turn led Sisera, who led the army to bring this victory. Chapter 5, you've got this great song called the Song of Deborah that Deborah and Barak sing. Really looks a lot like Deborah. Sang a lot of it. And it's kind of neat. If you have some time, go through it and read it. It's poetry, Hebrew poetry, but it tells a lot about the story and basically says where the victory came from. That God brought the victory. She also kind of counts off the tribes and talks about their part. Some of the tribes were very heavily involved, like Naphtali and Zebulun. They risked their own lives in this. Some of the others participated a little bit. Some of them didn't participate at all. And she says, Dan, why did you linger by the ships? And there was much searching of heart at Reuben and Gilead. Gad stayed beyond the Jordan. And, you know, so it goes on and talks about that. But it's also a big song of praise to God for his victory through this. All right, next judge. And in fact, this will be the last judge we'll talk about today, and we'll pick up the other judges. But this is a big one. This is Gideon. Okay? So, who was Israel's next oppressor, we see in chapter 6. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of Yahweh, and for 7 years he gave them into the hands of the Midianites. Because the powers of Midian were so oppressive, the Israelites prepared shelters for themselves in mountain clefts, caves, and strongholds. So Midianites came in. Okay, Midianites were a nomadic group that wandered around, came from the east. In fact, you see Moses, his father-in-law, was the high priest of Midian. Now, being a nomadic people, they would wander around trying to find food, trying to find land that could support their livestock and themselves, their people. And so they come into Israel. There's lots of the land flowing with milk and honey. There's lots there, and the Midianites come in like a flock of a swarm of locusts. And the Midianites were since they came to other people's lands, they were used to fighting for their right to be able to live in their lands and to eat of their land. So it was a risky time for the Israelites, so as a result, they hid. They hid themselves in clefts of mountains and in caves and in strongholds. So they were oppressed for 7 years, it says here. Now, 200 years earlier, we see that the Israelites had dealt with the Midianites before. Back in Numbers chapter 22, verse 7, we see that the elders of Moab and Midian left, taking with them the fee for divination. When they came to Balaam, they told him what Balak had said. So when Balak was trying to get Balaam to curse the Israelites, the Midianites were involved with the Moabites in trying to get that done. And then later in chapter 31, we see a whole response to that. Yahweh said to Moses, take vengeance on the Midianites for the Israelites. After that, you'll be gathered to your people. And then jumping to verse 7, they fought against Midian as Yahweh commanded Moses and killed every man. So there was a big battle from the Midianites, between the Midianites and Israelites, because of the Midianites' involvement in the Balaam thing. And the Israelites won that battle. But now we have a whole new group of Midianites that come in, and well, what are they doing? Verse 3 of Judges chapter 6. Whenever the Israelites planted their crops, the Midianites, Amalekites, and other eastern peoples invaded the country. They camped on the land and ruined the crops all the way to Gaza. Gaza is way over at the coastline. So all the way through, this is basically saying the whole land they destroyed. And they did not spare a living thing for Israel, neither sheep, nor cattle, nor donkeys. So they not only ate of the land, but they ate of their flocks and animals. They came up with their livestock and their tents like swarms of locusts. It was impossible to count the men and their camels. Even their camels you couldn't even count. They invaded the land to ravage it. Midian so impoverished the Israelites that they finally cried out to Yahweh for help. Okay, seems things have to get kind of bad for them to turn to God. God wants them to turn to Him at all times. God wants us to turn to Him at all times, not just in bad times, but all the time. So, who does God raise up to save Israel, and how did He accept the call? Well, we have a story of a prophet from verse 7 through 10, and then verse 11. The angel of Yahweh came and sat down under the oak in Ophrah that belonged to Joash the Abizrite, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press. Okay, a wine press is a depressed area, and he was threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites, because if he did it out in the open where you usually want to thresh wheat, the Midianites would see him and take it and take him, whatever. When the angel of Yahweh appeared to Gideon, he said, "Yahweh is with you, mighty warrior." "But sir," Gideon replied, "if Yahweh is with us, then why has all this happened to us? And where's his wonders that our fathers told us about when they said, 'Didn't Yahweh bring us up out of Egypt?' But now Yahweh has abandoned us and put us in the hand of Midian." Well, we all know why. Yahweh turned to him, that is the angel of God, turned to him and said, "Go in the strength that you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you?" "But Lord," Gideon asked, "how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my family." So God sends an angel to Gideon, just a guy, okay, the son of Joash. And he's out just trying to thresh some wheat, and the angel goes, and Gideon says, "Where's God? Why is God letting all this happen to us? Why hasn't God rescued us?" And the angel goes, "Okay, you rescue him. Gideon, in your strength, and the strength of God, you go. Look, I'm sending you." Okay? So you know that God's behind you. And Gideon goes, "But hold it. I'm a nobody. I'm of the clan of Manasseh, which is not a key tribe. And my clan is the smallest, and that my family is the smallest. And me, I'm a nobody." So, sounds kind of similar to some of what Moses said when he was called by God. So how did God tell Gideon that he'd have all the power and might that he needed because God was on his side? Verse 16, Yahweh answered, "I'll be with you, and you will strike down all the Midianites together." Okay, so he'd have God's presence and God's power, and he would destroy the Midianites. Did that satisfy Gideon? Gideon replied, "If now I have found favor in your eyes, give me a sign that is really you talking to me." Okay. Gideon went in, verse 19, prepared a young goat and an ephah of flour. He made bread without yeast, and so he made this meal for the angel. The angel of God said to him, "Take the meat and the unleavened bread and place them on this rock and pour out the broth." So Gideon did so. With the tip of the staff that was in his hand, the angel of Yahweh touched the meat and the unleavened bread. Fire flared from the rock, consuming the meat and the bread. And then the angel of Yahweh disappeared. So, did God's promise to be with him and to bring him success and bring him victory satisfy Gideon? No, he kind of wanted a sign. He wanted to make sure this is not a figment of his imagination, that this is really God doing this. So he made this meal, put it down, and offered it as a sacrifice, and God ate it. Okay, fire from the rock consumed the sacrifice of meat and bread. So did that convince Gideon that this visitor really was from God? Going on. When Gideon realized that it was the angel of Yahweh, he exclaimed, "Oh, sovereign Yahweh, I've seen the angel of Yahweh face to face." Okay, so what's his thought? "I've seen God, so I'm going to die. No one can see God and live," we've been told. But Yahweh said to him, "Peace, shalom, calm down, don't be afraid. You will not die. You're not going to die." Okay, so Gideon built an altar to Yahweh, and it stands there called Yahweh Shalom, the Lord is peace. To this day it stands in Ophrah. So Gideon did believe, and so much so he was afraid because he had seen God. But then God told him, "Nope, I've called you for a purpose, not to kill you, because you've seen my angel." So, going on, how does God test Gideon's faithfulness to his calling? Verse 25, that same night, Yahweh said to him, take the second bull from your father's herd, the one 7 years old. Tear down your father's altar to Baal. So here we see his father has an altar to Baal. And cut down the Asherah pole beside it. So he's got an altar to Asherah here, an Asherah pole. Then build a proper kind of altar to Yahweh your God on the top of this height. Use the wood of the Asherah pole that you cut down and offer the second bull as a burnt offering. Okay? So he told Gideon to test his faithfulness to his calling, told Gideon to destroy his dad's Baal altar, destroy the Asherah pole, build a real altar to Yahweh, and offer a sacrifice of his dad's bull there. Well, sounds like, okay, no big deal, but it is a big deal. These shrines, these altars to Baal were on high places, and they weren't just for a family, but they were shared by the community. And so his dad apparently owned this land and where this was and maybe had built it, but the community would have used this altar and would have come to it. So with him tearing down this altar to Baal, he's not just tearing down something that belongs to his dad, but it belongs to the community. It's kind of a political thing. So how did the town react when they saw what had happened the next morning? Well, verse 27, Gideon took 10 of his servants and did as Yahweh had told him. But because he was afraid of his family and the men of the town, he did it at night rather than in the daytime. And then in the morning, when the men of the town got up, there was Baal's altar, demolished, with the Asherah pole beside it cut down, and the second bull sacrificed on the newly built altar. They said, "Who did this?" When they carefully investigated, they were told, "Gideon, the son of Joash, did it." Okay, so the town was upset. They heard about this. And the men of the town demanded of Joash, "Bring out your son. He must die because he has broken down Baal's altar and has cut down the Asherah pole beside it. How dare he stand up against Baal? And he's going to get Baal mad at us." So they were very upset. And they wanted to lynch Gideon for this horrible attack against Baal and Baal's altar and his Asherah pole. What happened? Did his dad send him out? What, you know, his dad didn't know about this either until that next morning. But Joash replied to the hostile crowd around him, "Are you going to plead Baal's cause? Are you trying to save him? Whoever fights for him shall be put to death by morning. If Baal really is a god, he can defend himself when someone breaks down his altar." So that day they called Gideon Jerubbaal. Saying, "Let Baal contend with him, because he broke down Baal's altar." Jerubbaal means let Baal contend. So that was a nickname that he was given, and we see him referred to as Jerubbaal over and over again. So his father said, if Baal's really a god, he can protect himself, so we don't need to worry about protecting Baal from Gideon. So if he's not going to protect himself, then maybe he's not really a god after all. So some good response there from someone who built this pagan altar. All right, going on. Well, let me just kind of keep going where we're at. Verse 33, "Now all the Midianites, Amalekites, and other eastern people joined forces and crossed over the Jordan and camped in the valley of Jezreel. Then the Spirit of Yahweh came upon Gideon, and he blew a trumpet, summoning the Abizrites to follow him. He sent messengers throughout Manasseh, calling them to arms, and also into Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, so they too went up to meet them." Okay, so now he's got an army, and the enemy is there, and so it's now time. So Gideon says to God, "If you will save Israel by my hand as you've promised," you know, there's this if thing. Well, he's promised, yes, he will, but Gideon's nervous about it. So he says, "Look, I'll place a wool fleece on the threshing floor. If there's dew only on the fleece, and all the ground is dry in the morning, then I will know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you said." And that's what happened. Gideon rose early the next day. He squeezed the fleece and wrung out the dew, a bowl full of water. But all the land was dry there. So he had asked for a sign just to know for sure. Okay, I remember you gave me a sign before, but I need another sign. Give me another sign. And God gives him another sign. So he's satisfied, right? Does this satisfy Gideon that God is with him? Going on. Then Gideon said to God, "Don't be angry with me, but let me make just one more request. Allow me one more test with the fleece. This time make the fleece dry and the ground covered with dew." Okay, obviously, you know, he hadn't thought through that fleece thing. Maybe that's the normal way it would happen. So just to make sure that God's involved, you know, let's do it the other way around. So that night, God did so. Only the fleece was dry. All the ground was covered with dew. So he knew. He got his sign to know for sure that God is with him. So he then gets this army. Early in the morning, Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all his men camped at the spring of Herod. The camp of Midian was north of them in the valley near the hill of Morah. Then Yahweh said to Gideon, "You have too many men for me to deliver Midian into their hands. In order that Israel may not boast against me that her own strength saved her, announce it to the people. Anyone who trembles with fear may turn back and leave Mount Gilead." So 22,000 men left, while 10,000 remained. So he had 32,000 men. God said, "That's way too many. I want it to be clear that this victory is coming from me. It's not being done because y'all got so many people. You need to see my hand at work. Israel needs to see my hand at work. So tell anybody who's afraid to go home." Out of 32,000, 22,000 leave. 10,000 are left. And what's interesting is if you look at verse 12, their enemy says the Midianites, the Amalekites, and the other eastern peoples had settled in the land as thick as locusts. Their camels could no more be counted than the sand on the seashore. So there were way too many Midianites to even count. But yet we know that there were, from 32,000, it came down to 10,000 Israelites here. But you know, that's still too many. Going on. Gideon took the men down to the water. Verse 4. So Yahweh said to Gideon, "There's still too many men. Take them down to the water and I'll sift them for you there. If I say this one shall go with you, then he'll go. But if I say this one shall not go with you, he shall not go." He kind of warns him so he can prepare the men. Because if I tell you not to go, that's God saying it, not me. Then Gideon took the men down the water, and there Yahweh told him, "Separate those who lap the water with their tongues like a dog from those who kneel down to drink." 300 men lapped with their hands to their mouths. All the rest got down on their knees to drink. Then Yahweh said to Gideon, "With the 300 men that lapped, I will save you and give you the Midianites into your hands. Let all the other men go, each to his own place." Okay? So he chopped down from 32,000 now down to 300. Less than 1% of the original number are left. Okay? How can 300 men conquer countless Midianites? Even their camels couldn't be counted. There are that many camels. There's no way they can. But there's a way God can. How does God... Well, we've already seen Gideon's nervous. Already he's asked three times for signs to make sure that this is God. And he's a reluctant leader here, but he's nervous about it. So how does God encourage Gideon in the face of 300 versus countless Midianites? Going on, verse 9. During that night, Yahweh said to Gideon, "Get up. Go down against the camp because I'm going to give it into your hands. If you're afraid to attack, go down to the camp with your servant Purah and listen to what they're saying. Afterward, you'll be encouraged to attack the camp." So he and Purah, his servant, went down to the outpost of the camp. The Midianites, Amalekites, and the others had settled in the camp there. Gideon arrived just as a man was telling a friend his dream. "I had a dream," he said. "A round loaf of barley bread came tumbling into the Midianite camp. It struck the tent with such force that the tent was overturned and collapsed." His friend responded, "Well, this can be nothing other than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, the Israelite. God has given the Midianites and the whole camp into his hands." When Gideon heard the dream and its interpretation, he worshipped God, and he returned to the camp of Israel and called out and said, "Get up, for Yahweh has given the Midianite camp into your hands." Okay? So God gave him some encouragement. He let him hear a Midianite's dream foretelling the victory that he had prepared for him. And that encouraged him. And then he goes on with his attack plan. Dividing the 300 men into three companies, he placed trumpets and empty jars in the hands of all of them with torches inside. "Watch me," he told them. "Follow my lead. When I get to the edge of the camp, do exactly as I do. When I and all who are with me blow our trumpets, well then, from all around the camp, blow yours and shout, 'For Yahweh and for Gideon.'" Okay, so he divided these 300 into three groups of 100. He took them and surrounded the Midianite camp with them on these mountains here. And they would approach the camp. And when Gideon sounded his trumpet, then they were all to blow their trumpets and shout. They had jars and torches, so they would take the torches out of the jars and break the jars to make even more noise. So they've got this noise here. And this was nighttime. This is the middle of the night here. Okay? How could making some noise in the middle of the night result in defeating the Midianites? Going on. Gideon and the 100 men with him reached the edge of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, just after they had changed the guards. It's around midnight. So they blew their trumpets and broke the jars that were in their hands. The three companies blew their trumpets and smashed the jars. Grasping the torches in their left hands and holding their right hands, the trumpets they were to blow, they shouted, "A sword for Yahweh and a sword for Gideon." While each man held his own position around the camp, all the Midianites ran, crying as they fled. So they were afraid. They were afraid of these Israelites. God had put fear in their hearts, and then they hear all this noise. They look up and they see these 300 torches and all these people shouting, "A sword for Yahweh and a sword for Gideon." They'd heard about Gideon, so it scared them. When the 300 trumpets sounded, Yahweh caused the men throughout the camp to turn on each other with their swords. The army fled to Bet Shittah towards Zerera, as far as the border of Abel Meholah, near Tabith. Israelites from Naphtali, Asher, and all Manasseh were called out, and they pursued the Midianites. Gideon sent messengers throughout the hill country of Ephraim, saying, "Come down against the Midianites and seize the waters of the Jordan ahead of them as far as Beth Barah." So basically, all the Jordan River from Sea of Galilee to the Dead Sea, they put guards there at all the fords. So the men of Ephraim were called out, and they took the waters of the Jordan as far as Beth Barah, and they seized the fords there so that they couldn't get across. And they captured the Midianite leaders, and they killed and captured all the Midianites. So you see this victory, and they really didn't have to fight. All they had to do was mop up, and it was an easy mop up because the Midianites were scared to death of them. Going on, chapter 8, you've got some stories here. The Ephraimites get upset with Gideon because he hadn't let them fight with him, but he goes on and says, "Yeah, but y'all got the leaders. That's a whole lot better than us." Then Gideon goes and pursues a couple of other leaders, Zeba and Zalmunna, and tries to ask for some bread, some food for his men as they are pursuing at a couple of cities, and those two towns wouldn't allow him. They said no. So as a result, he comes back and destroys those towns on the way back. Then after all this victory, we have this thing about Gideon's ephod at the end of chapter 8. Verse 22, we've read these verses. The Israelites said to Gideon, "Rule over us, you and your son and your grandson, because you've saved us out of the hand of Midian." But Gideon said, "I will not rule over you, nor will my son rule over you. Yahweh will rule over you." Okay? So he recognized that Yahweh is, God is the king. Okay? He's not there to become king. But he took advantage of the situation. He said, "I do have one request, that each of you give me an earring, just an earring, not much, from your share of the plunder." It was a custom of the Ishmaelites, the Midianites, to wear gold earrings. So they said, "Oh, we'll be glad to give them." So they spread out a garment, and each man threw a ring from his plunder onto it. The weight of the gold rings he asked for came to 1,700 shekels, which is about 43 pounds of gold. Okay? Not counting the ornaments, the pendants, and the purple garments worn by the kings of Midian, or the chains that were on their camel's neck that Gideon had already taken for himself. So Gideon did try to profit out of this. But then, on top of that, verse 27, Gideon made the gold into an ephod, okay, which is like a big robe that priests would wear, that he placed in Ophrah, his town. All of Israel prostituted themselves by worshiping it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and his family. So he took this gold and said, "Yeah, give me this." And he took the gold, made this robe out of it, and then set it up, hung it up on a wall, or set it up, and people came and worshipped it. So it became a snare. It became, you know, here, worshipping the Baals of the Canaanites wasn't enough for these people. Here they have to go worship this robe that Midian makes. Okay? God says, "Have no graven images before me. Worship me." Okay? So it became a snare, became a problem to them. that's kind of a sign, and plus you saw his reluctance and his lack of trust of God. So Gideon wasn't the most strong spiritually person, okay? He had some spiritual weakness. And we see that carries on into his family. And in chapter 9, you've got the story of Abimelech, and we won't read that, but it's a very interesting story, so I'd encourage you to read it. But Abimelech is one of his sons, a son by a concubine, by a prostitute, that he has a lot of wives, and Abimelech decides he wants to become king, and ends up killing all his brothers, ends up creating a problem for the Israelites who had accepted him as king, and they all kill each other and just create lots of problems. So it's an interesting story that you find in chapter 9, and it's all really the result of Gideon's spiritual shallowness, and that creating a problem for, and also the shallowness of Israel's spirituality and not trusting God. Okay, we'll pick up from here next week and cover the rest of the book of Judges. Let's close with prayer. God, our Father, we thank you for the stories that you've given us. We thank you for the stories showing the spiritual shallowness, the lack of faith, the rejection of you, of the Israelites. And even though they rejected you and they were quick to turn their backs on you and worship other gods, you were still there for them. You as a just God punished them, but you as a gracious and merciful God sent a Savior to them, sent saviors to save them, sent judges to save them, sent salvation to them, just as you do for us. Just as us, we turn from you. We worship other gods. You're a just God, and you punish that. The wages of sin is death. The troubles that we experience in our lives are the result of living in sin. But yet you're a gracious and merciful God, and you love us so much that you sent a Savior to us. You sent a judge. You sent a king. You sent your Son to come and pave the way and to bring us back to you and bring us salvation. Salvation that we don't deserve, just like the Israelites didn't deserve it back then. We thank and praise you that you call us your own. We thank and praise you that you love us so much that you'll forgive us even when we turn from you. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.